pretty, from the some of the reports that I've read, it's clear that the Canadian and U.S. governments have expressed some very serious concerns about the anti-globalization movement and about the radical wing within it.
Sure.
And
as well they should.
And you've written extensively on the repression in the 60s and the 70s about COINTELPRO. And I was wondering if you could talk about some of the lessons, some of the key lessons that radicals today should keep in mind. What can we learn from the past? How can we maneuver around? We know what the state's tactics will be. How can we be best prepared?
You have to be a thinking movement. I mean, again, catechisms don't work in this context. And the opposition has always been at least as catechismic in the overall as the church. And the contents of the catechisms, I guess we could make, is that the plural of catechism? Whatever that plural would be, you know. We've organized ourselves and organized our consciousness one way or another around a sort of a rote regurgitation of set principles that are often ill-defined and even more poorly understood. So ill-definition isn't even properly absorbed. I've spent my entire adult life interacting with Marxists, and I've only found three that can explain the famous dialectic. Okay? They don't know what it is. They embrace it. They organize around it. They dedicate their lives to it. They're, in some cases, willing to die for it, but they don't know what the fuck it is. What is a dialectic? See the problem? This is an act of faith, not of engagement of critical intellect. We can outthink these guys in certain respects, okay? Part of that is never underestimating what it is they're capable of, and never underestimating our capacity to come up with a sort of a situational response to... There's not a formula here, okay? I guess I'm having a hard time articulating this, but it's where I'm wanting to go. They've got an inventory of techniques, okay? They've got a... I don't know whether it's actually formulated or whether it's more intuitive and situational on their part. I don't know. A certain master document says in this set of circumstances you apply these techniques to get these results. Okay, they sort of got people who this is their inclination. They have an aptitude. They have a flair for it. They pretty much are rewarded for devoting their careers for it. They call it various things. It used to be counterintelligence. Now it's counterterrorism. Okay, you got guys who come in and when they're 19 years old and when they retire, that's what they've devoted their career to, and they get really goddamn good at it. And so in a certain sense, it's perceiving in the immediacy of a situation what might best, upon their experience, work to accomplish a desired result. So you can say it's more intuitive than codified, and our response has to be kind of the same. We've got to develop the bodies of expertise based and experience in dealing with these things, not just reading the books, okay, and understanding that we can't come up with a formula or a recipe of what it is that will work, but we've got to use common sense and critical understandings of how these processes have worked and to the best of our ability to obtain the information of what they have in place now. I mentioned that about the Delta Force. There's actually a protocol, okay, that allows for suspension of... This isn't legal, you understand, but procedurally allows the president at discretion to suspend Posse Comitatus Act and utilize the particular forces within the U.S. military construction for the maintenance of civil order. Okay, they go to the very highest shelf because this is a special of the special forces, a special operations formation, and it's one function. And this is what these guys do. This is all they do, okay? They train for and execute missions to take out strategic targets among oppositional groups wherever they happen to be. That's all Delta Force does. Okay? They ain't going to consult with the riot police. They're not going to do anything. They were there in case they were necessary to eliminate the leadership as defined by the intelligence sources of the U.S. of the people who were threatening to destabilize the World Trade Conference. They've been introduced to Atlanta prison riots. They were deployed at Waco, which ought to tell you something. And they were deployed at Ruby Ridge. Okay, I can name those. We've got the goods on it. Know the name of the protocol, and that needs to be absorbed into our collective understanding of what we're up against and shape the nature of our response patterns accordingly. Okay? This is a no ifs, and or buts proposition. They're unequivocal. If they are deployed and assigned to deal with the target. This is how they're going to deal with it, and that's the stakes of the game, and we need to temper our consciousness accordingly, which takes care of, we're going to do this by candlelit vigils, I think. We think good thoughts and make moral arguments, and persuasion and petition drives and electoral politics. All of these can be useful in terms of organizing our own communities, but it's going to have absolutely nil effect on the structure of power. We're going to have to get to the bare knuckle and understand the mechanics of power, how they ultimately maintain themselves. First, the sort of obfuscation, mystification, keeping people confused, keep people divided. People don't stay divided. They're going to ratchet it up to the next increment, which has to do with false incarcerations and all the rest of that. And ultimately, you're going to be dealing with U.S. military Delta Force and things like that. That's the terms of engagement. I run through all of that because that, by and large, even upon the self-described most militant sectors, there's not really a cognition of what it means. They consider themselves to be imbued with certain sets of options based upon varying degrees of social privilege, as if those were going to continue to apply if they actually become a serious threat to order. Now, based on that, in that consciousness, we begin to develop techniques that apply to the given situations. There's not a recipe for that either, but maybe it's affinity groups in some places, okay, and how affinity groups are structured is really a situationally contingent thing. In some cases, black blockers, say, for example, are going to be based on long-term friendships and interaction with people that they know are not infiltrators because, you know, they hooked up together before anybody was too young to have been recruited by the FBI in all probability, and they've evolved as a little group, insular, self-contained in a way ever since, and so it's really hard to penetrate one of those. Among indigenous people, it's often family units, you know. The national structure of the American Indian movement was penetrated pretty successfully, okay, because you had these people drawn together in an organizational sense from a whole variety of locations to function as a sort of a governing council, and that was a really bad model, where we were impenetrable in most part was actually on the ground with the action organization, the action end of the organization, in a way, because these were all family units. You know, it was the Means family, for example. It was the Robidoux Peltier and their cousins, you know, Robidoux Peltier, those guys, they were all related. They'd grown up together. Well, how exactly do you plant somebody in the middle of that? You don't. There's other ways of going at it. So I say affinity groups, however those are to be defined, might be the situational response in a given context. There are others. The thing that is most critically important in this particular construct is to really thoroughly understand the techniques that are used, usually at the lower levels, and not do the job for them. And that has to do with just gratuitously calling people cops in order to resolve political disputes, disagreements, whatever, which has been an endemic practice on the left. Often the police agencies, the intelligence agencies, don't even need to insert provocateurs because they can rely on the activists to do it to themselves. Maybe they stimulate it a few times, they plan a few documents, they do whatever they do, okay. The rule of thumb is, if it kind of Joe McCarthy, if it acts like a cop and it talks like a cop, whatever, maybe you treat it like a cop, but you don't call it one. You don't feed into that. If somebody is destabilizing and threatening by or another compromising the integrity or compromising the security of a group, you simply eliminate person by virtue of putting them outside the group. You don't make some big public show of it. You don't put out wanted posters on it unless you actually concretely have the evidence that this is a police operative, a police infiltrator. You never, ever say that. I'm sort of just landing on illustrations of commonsensical approaches to dealing with this. See, we put ourselves in such a compromised position through internal dynamics and bad practice that all they have to do is kind of take this tottering structure and push it in a given moment. Bad praxis is our worst enemy, not the police state at the level that we're organizing now. And there isn't anybody that I know of that's actually mounting clandestine operations to try to challenge the authority of the state in those terms at this point. We're in a building period, and how we build really is contingent in large part on the internalization of lessons like that.
A lot of what we've just been talking about seemed to do with tactics in regards to confronting the state or overcoming this repressive apparatus, and that's especially the case and that was also the case in the 60s, where there's various groups involved today are looking back at these tactics. But I was wondering if we can talk about a strategic viewpoint of mm-hmm. the situation in North America. And it was the viewpoint of the Weather Underground, or the sort of more a section of the radical left in the States back then, that the that basically the elements that were moving first into struggle and that were the actual radical forces that could overthrow the system were the movements that had nothing, you know, nothing to lose, or the least to lose and the most to gain from such struggle, and therefore that
theory
was
theory of lump and organizing.
Lump and organizing, the black liberation, you know, the looking to black people, looking to Native Americans, Latinos, etc. And this leaves this whole sort of question of the white working class and of the white settler society, which seems to be, I mean, another argument put forward by certain Marxist groups is that it's with at the point of production that capital is the weakest, that if you know, workers strike at a GM factory, they can shut down production at all these various places, that and that white workers are oppressed, there's lots of white people in poverty, and the importance is organizing on this this class basis, if you and not to confront any attempt to fight the state on its own terms, where it's the strongest in regards to any kind of direct military confrontation, will not succeed, or should be saved for the moment of insurrection on the eve of the revolution. And what I'm wondering if you could talk about is this: how do you achieve this destruction of state power without the conscious active support of the majority of people in society, which would include the white settler population of North America? And assuming that that's important, you need to find a way to get at them, to make them move on that. And is the white settler population so ingrained with colonialism and genocide and material benefits that it gains from the system that it will never move? Or will the empire? Is there a way to make the empire fall from within and with sections of that white settler society?
Well, now that you've posed a question and require a book to answer, I'm actually going to try to address it in some capsule form, and that's actually going to be the last question, because we're going to end up at 12:30, so I got a feeling my host is sitting in the lobby. Maybe he can sit for another 15 minutes or so. It's okay.
You might call. I would call if I was him.
Yeah, but then he might not. So. let's see. Ultimately, no, you can't win so long as the bulk of the population is actively in some fashion or another deployed against you, but that doesn't mean that the bulk of the population ultimately has to actively join you either. The process is one of attempting to neutralize the reaction to a considerable extent. And it goes, and this is where I think, although there were reasons for it at the time, they misunderstood what the dynamic was, okay, thought people were much more actively committed to physical engagement with the state than ultimately proved to be the case, and retrospectively, where hindsight can be brought to bear, well, it's clear that they weren't, okay, and that would apply absolutely to Weatherman. Okay, that they thought they were, this is an interesting middle-class white boy, mostly, although there were white women up the yin-yang who were involved in this as well, thought they saw a parade and tried to position themselves to lead it. They were going to be the vanguard. What's new? Okay, we got 300 white guys that decided that they've got their finger on a pulse of history, so they're going to jump in front, in a way. And they said they were acting in solidarity, but they were defining themselves as a vanguard. So, the white guys are going to lead the revolution. They just misdiagnosed the conditions that might precipitate revolution and ended up being self-isolating, both for that reason and for the reason that we were talking about a little earlier. This would also apply to the PLA and some of the others as well, although they had far stronger base in the community than the Weathermen ultimately turned out to have, okay? The significance or the role of the armed struggle, I think, was really profoundly misunderstood at that particular juncture by virtually all of the actors participating in it, that the armed struggle was at that time going to be the catalyst, the decisive element in bringing about a sort of comprehensive transformation of society. And that wasn't it at all. What was happening that gave that appearance and led them to the false conclusion was a withdrawal of consent on the part of increasingly massive numbers of people. And I mean, you really had significant proportion of the population that was rejecting, not usually in whole, but in substantial part, the thrust of U.S. policy. They weren't going to go to war with it, they just were not going to contribute to it. And the degrees of withdrawal and the form that that took was pretty diverse. But that's the key. You don't have to have the preponderance of the population engaged in some sort of a final Joppian or Maoist campaign to bring down the government. What you got to do is have the ability to cause an increasing number of people to withdraw consent from some key sectors of functioning of power to begin to erode the hegemony, all right? And of that increasing number of people who are withdrawing consent, have some, I couldn't put a proportionate to it, I couldn't name a number, but some appreciable number of those going into more active forms of resentment, of resistance and undermining and so forth, and be supported in that rather than be supported at least to the extent that people won't give you up to the cops. Be supported in the sense that maybe they'll make contribution, be, you know, monetarily or provide you sanctuary or whatever, the famous sea that Mao always talked about, which the guerrilla swims. Even in that context, it was understood that the bulk of the population were not going to be active guerrillas, but that they were not going to be supporting the government in some ways that were of crucial importance. And I think that's attainable over the long haul, okay? Because what you're doing, there's sort of a reverse dynamic. As the opposition strengthens, even though it's never going to be numerically the largest portion of things, okay, if you're looking, especially if you're looking at things in terms of dismantling rather than transforming the given structure, okay, you have to have a much greater weight in order to take the structure intact and then rearrange its organization, as opposed to the kind of weight that is necessary to have it begin to unravel and collapse. And that's actually the aspiration that I hold. As the opposition increases its weight, the effective force of the state diminishes. This is a reverse proportionality, okay? If you're having to withdraw the consent in order to obtain that which will be oppositional, it's going to be working, well, ratcheting up slowly here, but dropping here at a much greater weight so that you're getting an increasing degree of parity throughout the whole process. That's the key element. So you can critique but should not condemn people who are engaged in activities which lead to a withdrawal of consent in some discernible way. Got to find working relationships. But now, here's another piece of it that sort of accelerates the process, and this is, it's a sort of triangular proposition. You got to be creating counter models, not that you're going to supplant the structure of the state with co-ops or little land occupations or whatever else, but you're creating counter models that people can look at that can be attracted to. Oh yeah, there is another way of doing this. And maybe I'd be more comfortable in that context. I don't know for sure because I haven't lived in it, but it looks like something I might like to explore. So you're attracting, that leads to this withdrawal, this doubt as to the inevitability of the state structure, and that's what you're trying to inculcate. So these land occupations, these creating of counter models, cooperatives, collectives, and so forth, if approached that way as exemplary models, not the, they are in some sense prefigurative relations, but you got this whole notion that was current during the 70s in particular that you could simply create a society you wanted within the shell of the old one, and eventually the old one would wither away. It's kind of like the Marxist or the Leninist theory of the state, you know. Well, that ain't going to happen either. You're going to reach a certain threshold and they're going to begin to actively repress you, try to jack at you. That was the thing that did especially well with the Breakfast for Children program, the community clinics, the alternative educational institutions, job placement, housing initiatives, all the rest of that, which just viewed as a package in and of themselves, this is a very liberal agenda. Okay. But it was framed in terms, explicitly so, of removing those service delivery vectors and responsibility for them from the state, the tit of the state, okay, placing them in the hands of the community. They'd be initiated by the party, but the community would take them over, and it was framed in terms of a very coherent articulation of a program of self-determination, self-sufficiency. All right? I don't see a lot of that happening these days. Probably most among anarchists, again, who are organizing their little collectives, and you know, they get together and eat their bean sprouts and shit, and, you know. Okay, but it's only for themselves, present time. And we've been talking hard about that, you know. You want to talk to factory workers, you need to connect with them where they are, not where you think they should be. You need to get over your prohibition on ashtrays, because, you know, you keep asking me why nobody shows up except you. When you organize an event, like we had this big one in prisons up in Eugene, there's the answer. I've answered the question about 15 times. You're still doing what the city council does. Look, for starters, it's at this elementary level. You may have ideas, you may have counter models, and they might be constructive, but if people coming from the bowling alley or something have to spend 15 minutes reading your fucking signs of what they can't do for in exchange for the privilege of being able to enter your sacred premises, they gonna go bowling. You know? Get over your bicycles and your whatever, okay, go down and bend a wrench with a gearhead for a while. Do what he's fucking doing. Maybe he'll learn how to talk to you and vice versa. See? But that's like shedding the black uniforms, you know, it's a real psychological barrier to them because they've got the solution to the world's problems somehow in inchoate form in their minds, and they posit an implicit demand that people are supposed to acknowledge the superiority of their vision as a price of admission. So get the fuck off the university campus and down into a union hall, put ashtrays in the goddamn tables, make some babysitting services. Yeah, babysitting, okay, this isn't child care, it's babysitting, right? Make those services available, solicit, and try to package it in a set of terms that can appeal to the people you're trying to reach. Yeah, develop your counter models, but how you call it spin, if you will, call it packaging, call it Madison Avenue, how you peddle it, how you try to reach people is really, really important. And they're going to get Mohawk haircuts, and they probably aren't going to put safety pins in their eyelids and all the rest of that shit. I understand why you're doing it, and I'm not objecting. It's just that you got to cognate there's some other people out here you need to reach if you're going to be successful that don't feel that way, and you need to respect that. Because you're ultimately demanding that they respect you, fair enough, but that's a reciprocal proposition. That was probably barely coherent, but maybe you can winnow enough out of it to sort of get the drift of what I'm trying to get at.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks, works good.